Yeah, that guy is just irrelevant.
Podcasting from an underground studio flying under the radar, this is Dan. By day, I'm a professor of cognitive neuroscience, and by night, I retreat into my subterranean lair and dig deep into the thoughts of mankind.
And I'm Dave, sitting firmly atop the Great Canadian Shield in Northern Ontario. I'm a pastor by profession, and a part of that includes unmasking the messaging that comes at us each and every day.
We will not conform.
Deconstructing the Marvel Universe, welcome to the Not Conformed Podcast.
Dave, I'm looking at the list of audio clips for the show, and I see that you have a lot of movie clips for us to play and analyze.
That's right. Today, I want to spend a little bit of time analyzing how stories, especially in the form of movies or novels or really any kind of media, can influence our worldviews and how, in some cases, they are actually cunningly crafted to do just that.
So it's like the Not Conformed show at the movies.
Exactly.
I guess because this is essentially a continuation of our last few episodes, perhaps we should start with a quick recap.
That's a good idea. So in the last two episodes in Worldview Subversion and Genocidal Storytelling, we discussed the concept of one's worldview. And we drew upon a definition by Dr. Ken Funk, who writes, "A worldview is the set of beliefs about fundamental aspects of reality that ground and influence all one's perceiving, thinking, knowing, and doing." So one's worldview can often be referred to as one's philosophy of life, one's mindset, outlook on life, formula for life, ideology, faith, or even religion.
Yes, and our listeners may recall that we began to identify tools and techniques that are used to subvert or to alter your worldview. And the first technique we talked about was destabilization, which involves a disruption of a person's sense of self, their grounding, and their grasp on reality. And specifically, destabilization can be achieved through the use of psychedelic drugs, through the use of fear and intimidation. And the second technique we mentioned was rewriting history. And this technique involves anchoring people into a different conceptualization of history, which is meant to build a different foundation for their understandings of themselves and of current events and even of future events.
And then we discussed the third technique, which was the use of story, specifically the use of story to convey an alternative worldview. We discussed the importance of the stories that we tell, the stories that our children are reared on, and how they are used to convey fundamental worldview concepts. And we argued that the embedding of worldview concepts in the various storytelling media is not accidental, but subversively pervasive in all the mass media. And really, the quickest way to transform the worldview of a culture in only a generation is to embed the worldview concepts that you want to inculcate into the stories that our children engage with on a daily basis, and then simply hammer them home through repetition.
Indeed.
Yeah. And so in this episode, we want to point out some worldview modification techniques that are used specifically within the context of storytelling. In the movies and TV shows that you watch, that your kids watch, in the novels that you read, in the novels and storybooks that your kids read, in the video games that your kids play, and in the music that they listen to.
Dave, of the different types of fiction-based media you just mentioned, we're probably going to spend most of our time discussing superhero movies, particularly those that are part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which I guess begs the question, why should our listeners and why should we care about these fictional superhero movies?
Well, Dan, the simple answer is that this is the modern myth-making genre of our day, without a doubt. Our listeners might remember the clip from Phil Borges, that TEDx clip from last episode, where he quotes Joseph Campbell as saying, "Cultures are created, maintained, and transformed by stories that we often refer to as myths." And he goes on to say, "Myths are symbolic stories. They're metaphors that give us meaning and teach us how to act." Well, I will put out there that I would say that the superhero genre fills that role today. And to that, I would add the Star Wars movies, anything in that techno-fantasy genre, or what's sometimes called soft science fiction genre.
There's a telling statement in an article published in The Hollywood Reporter, and this is an article published on July 22nd, 2019, and it's titled, "His Brand is Excellence, How Leonardo DiCaprio Became Hollywood's Last Movie Star." And here's a quote. Yeah. In an age of pre-branded franchises and social media currency, DiCaprio is a Hollywood unicorn, able to gross hundreds of millions of dollars without wearing a cape, wielding a lightsaber, or even having an agent. End quote. And then it goes on to say, in fact, he's arguably the only global superstar left in a film industry in which an interchangeable group of actors regularly suit up in spandex or brandish a lightsaber for the latest billion-dollar earner. Unlike waning megastars like Will Smith, Jennifer Lawrence, and Robert Downey Jr., DiCaprio sits alone atop the Hollywood pantheon without ever having made a comic book movie, family film, or pre-branded franchise, end quote. So the story is about DiCaprio, obviously, but the implication here is that the most famous stars are in some kind of superhero film and that superhero films are dominating the movie industry. And Dave, I think these superhero films have a massive viewership. Just to give our listeners an idea of the reach of some of these Marvel films, the 2018 film Avengers Infinity War grossed almost $260 million on its opening weekend.
Yeah.
And that's second in all-time history, just behind the most recent Avengers Endgame. And this is according to a website called Box Office Mojo. And the same website reports that Avengers Infinity War grossed over $2 billion since its release worldwide. And that was in 2018. So just over the past year and a bit, $2 billion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Dave, as you probably know, the latest installment in the franchise, Avengers Endgame, is breaking all the records. So the reach of these movies is simply mind-boggling.
Yeah, absolutely, Dan. I was just looking at on Wikipedia in the top 10 grossing, highest grossing films of all time. And Avengers Endgame is listed as $2.79 billion at
wow.
this point. And like you said, Avengers Infinity War is just over $2 billion. So these things are absolutely, and in fact, if you look at the top 10, five of them are from the Marvel Cinematic Universe, four Avengers movies and Black Panther. And eight out of 10 of them are this fantasy fiction. There's only two, Titanic and Furious 7, which is just an action movie, that are in the top 10 that don't fit this genre. So
wow.
Now, and even when you look at the inflation adjusted numbers, which are different because you have Gone with the Wind and those kind of movies in there, Sound of Music, when inflation is adjusted. But even there, five of the top 10 are in this space-based fantasy genre.
Yeah, it's all about these comic book superheroes.
That's right. There's an article that I saw. It's titled "Non-Superhero Movies We Want to See in 2019," and the opening paragraph just openly admits, you know, some are already calling 2019 the year of the superhero movie, and there's
wow.
close to a dozen Marvel, Warner Brothers, DC, and Fox X-Men titles coming out this year. To say nothing of caped crusader fare like M. Night Shyamalan's Glass and Alita Battle Angel that's adapted from some manga, and Lego Movie 2, which stars Batman.
So
that's the opening, you know, we're hoping to see other non-superhero movies. That's what these guys are talking about. So even if the genre is not your thing, it can't be ignored as a worldview influencer simply because of the sheer number of eyeballs that it commands.
And the trajectory suggests that it's only going to get worse since more movies are slated to come out in this genre.
That's right. It's a giant soap opera that seems to be taking over the whole movie industry. Dan, in a recent article, this is the title. So, belief in E.T. will soon replace faith in God.
Yeah.
And here's a quote.
Oh, boy.
A belief in aliens could replace religious belief in the near future as more people are convinced of the existence of extraterrestrials than God, according to a U.S. professor. Now, look, when you consider that we have less evidence for the existence of intelligent life on some far-flung planet than we have for the existence of God, you have to ask yourself where this belief is coming from.
Yes.
Right? And I believe it comes from this myth-making that arose with the birth of the science fiction genre in the early last century and mid-last century, and it just gathered steam as the special effects have become better and better and better.
Yeah. Well, so let's analyze some of the worldview change techniques that are being used in movies and particularly in these superhero films.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Dave, let me introduce this first worldview change technique that we want to talk about. And I got to get some music here. And let's begin with the first worldview change technique of the show, controlling the constraints of a fabricated reality.
All right. So, like you said, the first technique involves the fabrication of a reality with cunningly chosen constraints. And essentially, what we're talking about here is that we have to remember that the storyteller is God. The storyteller has complete control over the universe that he creates and the perceptions that the characters have of their reality. He fully controls the compatible worldviews that logically exist in his creation. Okay, he has full control over all the aspects of worldview that we discussed earlier. So why does this matter? Well, on one level, okay, it's obvious the author has complete creative control. That's fine. But you cannot underestimate how much power this gives the author in presenting his particular worldview. So, for example, if the storyteller wants to make, let's say, belief in God appear to be simply stupid, right? He can easily do so by fabricating a universe where the belief in God is stupid. And I mean stupid in the sense that it's completely incongruous with the reality that the character experiences. There simply is no room in his crafted reality for an entity like the creator God of the Bible.
Dave, do you have some concrete examples or an example of this playing out in the movies?
Yeah, I have a couple of clips, and these come from the DC movie Green Lantern that illustrate this nicely. Now, it was one of these failed movies, but it provides an excellent example of how this works. So this first clip is from the opening scene of the movie, and it's one of these monologue scenes that lays out the universe that the characters inhabit.
Billions of years ago, a race of immortals harnessed the most powerful force in existence. The emerald energy of willpower. These immortals, the guardians of the universe, built a world from where they could watch over all of existence, the planet Oa. They divided the universe into 3,600 sectors. A ring powered by the energy of will was sent to every sector to select a recruit. In order to be chosen by the ring, it was said one must be without fear. Together, these 3,600 recruits formed the intergalactic peacekeepers known as the Green Lantern Corps. Of all the threats the Corps ever faced, the gravest was an entity of fear known as Parallax. Only the legendary Green Lantern, Abin Sur, was capable of capturing and imprisoning this beast, which he did on the lost planet of Riot.
Okay, so just in the first minute and a half of the movie, you have clear worldview elements. You have clear statements pertaining to some of those things we talked about before, to cosmology, mm-hmm. That's beliefs about the origins and nature of the universe and life. You've got statements pertaining to metaphysics, beliefs about the ultimate nature of reality. You've got statements that pertain to teleology, that's beliefs about the meaning and purpose of the universe, its inanimate elements and its inhabitants. You've got statements pertaining to theology, beliefs about the existence and nature of God, in this case, clearly not the God of the Bible, but some race of immortals. And you've got axiological statements, that is, beliefs about the nature of value of what is good and bad, what is right and wrong, this emerald energy of willpower versus this yellow energy of fear. And as the movie progresses, we are presented with all the remaining components of a complete worldview. Definite beliefs pertaining to anthropology, beliefs about the nature and purpose of man in general and oneself in particular, and epistemology, beliefs about the nature and source of knowledge.
Yeah, that intro certainly did paint a colorful picture of the worldview that audiences are asked to enter when viewing this movie.
That's right. And this movie wasn't very good, but they did the same sort of thing in Black Panther. They right at the opening scene, this narration. And it's a good example of how sometimes these ideas are scattered throughout the movie. Sometimes they're just boom right there. And I've got one more clip from the end that illustrates this just a little bit more.
Help me save my planet. Don't give in to fear. Fight it. Fight it with me.
Your words are compelling, young human. But as immortals, we must measure our actions over billions of years and the fate of the universe. We simply cannot risk losing everything on the chance you might be right.
Yeah, that's interesting. There's even a clear specification of the timeline, billions of years, that we are asked to accept as we watch the film.
That's right. And you've got statements about the nature of God or the gods and the nature of good and evil and man's position and purpose and significance in the universe. And it goes on. This movie is really packed with stuff like that. And I've got a few clips to illustrate some other things that we might get to later on. Mm-hmm. Basically, you have a full worldview packaged in this movie. Now, Dan, getting back to the idea of how a storyteller or filmmaker can use his carefully chosen constraints to make your worldview incoherent in his reality. And the example I mentioned earlier is making belief in God seem irrational. All the filmmaker has to do, for example, is in the midst of a scene where that ever-growing goo of fear is consuming the city, or in some other movie where these, you know, the giant black hole opens and there's these alien reptilian-type ships pouring out all over the earth. All he has to do is cut to a scene of a priest or a person praying, and the first thing that comes to mind to you as the audience is, that guy is just irrelevant or he's misguided, or, you know, we know who will really save the world. It's going to be the Green Lantern, or it's going to be the Avengers or whatever. Now, I can't remember if they did that in this movie, but just pay attention to how they treat the Christian faith and prayer and devout Christians and pastors and priests in these movies. And priests are useful because they're visually distinct visually identifiable with their clerical collar. And usually they're portrayed as impotent and as powerless and as useless and as charlatans or at best these well-meaning humanists or, you know, pseudo-psychologists. But always they have to be tragically flawed and hypocritical.
Yeah, and sometimes they're just silly.
That's right.
Yeah.
Now, for the audience, if you are continually exposed to these fictional realities and you identify with the characters in these realities, some of their assumptions and perceptions are going to rub off on you and influence the way you see the world, right? There's no way of enjoying a movie like Green Lantern or Black Panther or what have you if you don't in some way suspend your disbelief and grant permission to the worldview underpinning the movie for at least the duration of the movie.
Yeah, otherwise you can't get into it.
Exactly. You have to be able to allow yourself to identify with the character to some extent. Mm-hmm. And when the movie is over and you leave, what you're going to remember is the emotions and the sentiments that you felt as you identified with the characters during the movie. And you're not necessarily going to remember how you arrived at feeling that way or how the character arrived at feeling that way. So if the character was struggling with their faith, or if the character was disenchanted with God, or if the character came to the logical conclusion that God could not possibly exist because of the carefully crafted constraints of that universe, well, a little bit of that, a residue of that, is going to stay with you and will linger in your mind. And repetition, which we'll discuss it later, amplifies this effect.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting here is that when you agree to sit through and enjoy a movie and to willingly enter the reality created, you have demonstrated to yourself some degree of commitment to the fictional reality. So in other
That's
words,
right.
Yeah, you have submitted to the writers. And this sort of submission to a worldview that's different from yours might lead you to feel dissonance. Okay, what do I mean by dissonance here? So dissonance is a psychological term for an aversive psychological state that a person typically strives to minimize. And it emerges whenever you have conflict or incoherence within yourself in some way. And one way to minimize the dissonance is to compromise your pre-existing worldview and to accept some of the elements of the new worldview. So I think there is a very deep psychological dynamic at play here that these movie writers are exploiting to affect worldview change.
Yeah, I agree.
Another example of how a writer can construct a story in such a way that the writer's worldview is baked into the logical structure of the reality they create can be found in the Marvel's Netflix superhero show, Jessica Jones. Now, for those who haven't seen the show, Jessica Jones gained super strength and fast healing powers after receiving an experimental treatment following a car accident. And in the show, she plays the role of a private investigator who somewhat reluctantly helps others. She's portrayed as this reluctant hero struggling with her own problems, including depression, alcoholism, and a series of dysfunctional relationships throughout the seasons. Dave, have you seen the show?
Yeah, it's a total mess.
Yeah.
The character's a mess.
In season 3 of the show, the writers introduce another character with special powers, a powered person, as they say, named Eric Geldin. And his special power is that he gets headaches whenever he's in proximity of a person who has done bad things. The more immoral things a person has done, the more painful are Eric's headaches. So we could say that he has a built-in morality meter. And he can't control this, by the way. This just happens to him. And so let's think about this for a minute. What the writers have done here is to introduce what amounts to an objective morality meter in the fictional reality. They no longer have to make the case in the narrative that someone's actions are moral or immoral based on a character's subjective judgment, and they don't have to worry about what moral judgments the audience might make. With this morality meter, the morality judgments are simply asserted as foundationally and objectively real. And with that, the writers have full control over what's moral in their universe, which allows them to mold the morality of the audience. So for example, Jessica Jones can destroy evidence in an investigation, and she can engage in sexually promiscuous behavior. And since Eric Geldin doesn't get a headache when he's around her, the implication is that her behavior is moral, at least that it's not sufficiently immoral to raise any concerns. And in fact, in the show, he sleeps with her, and that makes his headaches go away completely. Right? So it's like this, what Christians would say is an immoral act, actually on this objective moral meter is kind of indicates that was a very moral and good thing to do. Mm-hmm. But the writers can communicate even more complex moral dynamics. In one instance, Eric goes with another character, Trish, who's also powered, by the way, to confront this bad guy. And Eric knows he's a bad guy because when he previously was near this person, Eric got a major headache. Well, in the confrontation, Trish ends up beating the bad guy to death. And in fact, this happened several times. And here's what Eric has to say about his headaches in a conversation with Jessica Jones about these instances where Trish beat up these guys.
Yeah, there's something else. When they died, my headaches lifted. It was like the balance of all the crap in the world suddenly tilted toward good. It was euphoric.
Euphoric?
The headache, 1 to 10.
For Trish? 5-ish.
So killing these bad people tilts the balance in the world towards good. And Trish, who beats the bad guys to death, ends up only a 5 out of 10 on the headache meter. So that's not good.
Great.
Yeah, it's not good, but it's not terrible either. And the implication there is that she might still be savable, unlike the really bad guys who are not savable. In any case, the point here is that the audience is enticed into abdicating their sense of moral judgment and into just going with the flow of this objective moral headache meter that is built into the fabric of the fictitious reality.
Yeah, that's a great point, Dan, especially this idea of abdicating your sense of moral judgment. I think, so again, this is the storyteller playing God, creating the boundaries and the logic of this fictional reality. And as we said, this can make certain aspects of their worldview self-evident in the constraints of that fictional reality. And these worldview elements then rub off on the audience.
Yes, let's turn to another worldview change technique. And I got to get my music going again here. And it's time for our next worldview change technique of the show, the Trojan horse technique. Now, our listeners might recall the story of how, after failing to conquer the city of Troy, Greek soldiers concealed themselves inside a wooden horse that was left behind as the Greeks pretended to abandon the war. And the people of Troy brought the horse inside the city, at which point the soldiers came out of the wooden horse and opening the gates of the city. If I remember correctly, they let some other Greek soldiers into the city, and so ultimately conquering the city. And this was obviously initiated from inside the city, right? So based on this old story, the Merriam-Webster Dictionary defines Trojan horse, which is the term we're using for this worldview change technique we're going to discuss, as, quote, someone or something intended to defeat or subvert from within, usually by deceptive means, end quote.
Yeah, so here we want to use the Trojan horse technique to refer to stories that overall have elements that are appealing to or consistent with the audience's worldviews, but also involve more or less hidden messages aimed at changing or subverting the audience's worldviews.
The reason I think this sort of technique is so effective is that it allows the audience to fix their analysis on the dominant elements that are consistent with their worldview, such as good fighting evil, let's say, or self-sacrifice for the benefit of others in these superhero films. And this makes people complacent in their analysis of the more minor but subversive elements in the show. So people let their guard down and consume the whole thing, allowing the subversive elements of the story to influence their worldview.
Yeah, exactly. And Dan, I have a particularly nasty example of this Trojan horse technique. And sadly, it was in last summer's blockbuster for kids.
For kids?
For kids, yeah. It was the animated movie Show Dogs.
Okay, I haven't seen this one, so you got to tell me about it.
Okay, so first of all, this example was so obvious that it was spotted by a number of people and they were vilified as those mommy bloggers that are complaining. And it became a bit of a PR nightmare for the production companies that put this movie out. So I have a clip from a USA Today report that outlines the controversy.
A talking police dog goes undercover with his human partner to save an adorable baby panda.
A baby panda was stolen and they're using the dog show as a front for animal smuggling.
It sounds like the makings of a fun and innocent kids movie. But parents and advocacy groups warn underneath the childish jokes and slapstick humor directed at kids.
What's that?
Bikini wax?
What?
Show Dogs portrayed the disturbing and dangerous message.
So imagine it's summer, last summer, and parents are looking for some inane cartoon movie to entertain their kids. And for the most part, it's just that. It's inane. It's a silly kids movie, except that the Trojans have offered up their horse, and in this case, it takes the form of a situational slapstick.
Yeah, but Dave, listen, I think there's something worse going on here. I want to just play the beginning of that again, okay? Listen.
A talking police dog goes undercover with his human partner to save an adorable baby panda.
Okay, so you see, there is essentially a storyline here where somebody saves somebody. So this is something that to most people would be very appealing, right? To parents. Oh, this is a good moral. I want my kids to see this because they'll learn some good morals. And that's the shell of the horse, right? That they're inviting in.
That's right. That's right. And then the offending scene also comes in as they excuse it. Oh, we just thought we were putting situational slapstick. But roll the next segment and it'll explain a little bit about what the problem is.
The first to raise a red flag, mom blogger Tarina Maldonado's post quickly went viral, spreading like wildfire from mom to mom on social media. Maldonado is talking about the multiple scenes in the film when Max, a police dog's genitals, are touched. Max is voiced by Ludacris. In the film, he's first coached by his FBI partner, played by Will Arnett, that he must allow the touching in order for him to succeed. Later, he's touched by dog show judges, even though he's clearly uncomfortable, which has made some viewers also uncomfortable.
Yeah, so I didn't try to find clips of the offending scene as it was subsequently cut from the movie, but the next segment explains it even more.
And Dave, it seems like this wasn't just one little short clip or one instance. It seems like this was a theme they were actually developing in the story. Is that correct?
That's right. And in some ways, this is a failed Trojan because they had to cut it out. But in other ways, I think there's enough segments in this thing that that they didn't cut out that still get the point across.
Okay, yeah. Here's your next clip.
Well, my gut kind of sunk a little. I thought, what in the world? I kind of didn't know what to think. It was kind of dumbfounding. Is that really on a movie right now that my kids are watching?
In these scenes, Max is told to go to a Zen place while the inspection occurs. The National Center on Sexual Exploitation says the scenes send a, quote, troubling message that grooms children for sexual abuse, end quote. Show Dogs production company, Global Road Entertainment, apologized to parents.
Yeah, so the rough ending there was actually part of the report. And what they did was they cut to the screen to just simply, they cut her sound off and went to screen printed apologies. And it seems like in the original take, she was actually just kept on talking. But in the final version, the editors decided to just cut off whatever she said next. Maybe it wasn't quite kosher with the production companies and put the apologies on the screen.
Yeah, was, you know, Dave,
this was a fiasco.
Really, this is really illuminating for me. Because I think now I see the end goal of all this mindfulness meditation training that the kids are engaging in school. It's there to facilitate the future introduction of pedophilia. I mean, this is frightening.
It could be, because essentially the advice that the hero dog receives so that he can cope with the touching of his genitals is the same advice, it's the same approach that pedophiles are known to use with small children to prepare them to accept their perverted advances.
Yeah, just go to your technique. Special place. Go to your Zen. Start meditating and dissociate and go to your special place. That's what the kids are actually being taught in these meditative techniques in schools. And so, yeah, this connection, I mean, wow, intriguing.
Yeah, yeah. So I have one more clip that concludes the report.
Without watching movies for yourself, it's hard to know what message your kids are getting.
So that's good advice, right? It's sound advice. How else are you going to end this? But, and it's the same advice that I would offer, but it's practically hard to do. And I know as a parent, you know, who wants to sit through these silly movies twice and pay for the tickets twice? And it gets even harder with the more kids you have. I remember when, my oldest children were younger, we did more of that than we do today.
And yeah, I can say the same thing for us.
That's right. And when it comes to TV shows, the important thing to realize is that these Trojan horses get buried deep within the shows. So, for example, you might preview first few episodes. You might even preview the first season, but the payload or the bigger Trojan horses are going to be packed into the second season or into the third season. For example, I'll have some clips to illustrate another worldview technique change a little bit later from Supergirl, which is now on Netflix. And it's not till the second season that all of a sudden her sister comes out as being gay.
Right. So you might watch, the parents might watch the initial few episodes. Everything seems fine. And let's say the parents don't agree with homosexuality. They have no idea that that's being built into later episodes, into later seasons.
That's right. That's right. Or in an episode of, Dan, you might remember that cartoon Voltron that was in the 80s that you and I grew up with. And so they remade it with better animation, and they went for 8 seasons, short seasons. And it wasn't until the very last closing frame that they're just throwing up these pictures with captions to say, oh, and after the conflict is over, this is what happened to the characters. And the very last frame of the very last 8th season, there comes the LGBT payload.
By the way, Dave, I think we should confess that our parents actually never let us watch Voltron. Didn't we sneak that show mostly?
Exactly, yeah.
And that little 13-inch black and white TV.
We had the benefit of not actually being allowed to watch stuff. And that's probably one of the reasons why we have some critical eye on this stuff. But you know, Dan, the reason I'm calling these Trojan horses, some of these themes that we just mentioned aren't very very hidden. They're very overt, but I'm going to call these Trojan horses because they're already, you've already committed to the show and you want to see it through, and the payload comes much later, especially when parents might not be watching.
Yeah, I also noticed this in the Marvel show The Flash, which we discussed in a prior episode. That theme of shamanism comes in its full glory only later in later seasons. And so it's the same kind of trajectory. And I think you make a great point here, Dave. Parents likely give up checking on the show after the first few episodes, and it's in these later episodes when they're no longer watching that the subversive information is introduced. This is a great point. I got to give you one of these.
Great point, Uncle Dave.
Well, let me add to that before we move on and talk about, you've already mentioned Jessica Jones, which is another one of these Marvel properties on Netflix. Now, here's the thing. There is a huge difference between the Marvel Cinematic Universe and the Marvel series on Netflix. The Marvel Cinematic Universe are designed to be rated PG, but even in there, you have over the span of the last 22 some odd movies, the language in the first few was very clean, and they actually, you know, they were much cleaner than just about anything else you could watch. And over time, I remember in one of the movies, all of a sudden Captain America drops some kind of curse word, and he's chided by Tony Stark about it. And they just, over time, more and more language gets built into the shows because you're already committed to the universe. Now, so that's the Marvel Cinematic Universe in the movies. Now, moving over to Netflix, all of a sudden, as a parent, you might say, oh, this is just another one of those comic book things. Go ahead and watch it. Well, the problem is that the Netflix series should really be rated R.
There's a lot of adult content in there.
Absolutely. And in fact, I just end up fast forwarding through a lot of it because of that adult content. If I'm looking for clips or whatever, or watching it in general, because it's just simply, the violence is extremely visceral. There's a lot of sexual content. There's a lot of, substance abuse, alcohol abuse, basically everything that's it's not suitable for watching, certainly not for kids. And that's another form of this Trojan horse, because you might think, ah, it's just another comic book show, go ahead and watch it. But it's not. It's not at all. Most things on Netflix are quite, the ratings are not suitable for young audiences.
Yeah, and the sexual content is becoming more and more pornographic on these TV shows. And so, parents might think, oh, this is just a comic book series type show. I could let my kids watch it. But what they're really getting is heavy R-rated, bizarro stuff. And again, not only the maybe the sexual content and the swearing and the violence, but there's a lot of dysfunction, a lot of substance abuse and familial dysfunction, relationship dysfunction. So you're not learning anything positive from these
and
shows.
Addictions being yes. modeled. There's a lot of payloads in these things. And, you know, I used that Show Dogs example as a Trojan. It was obvious that the mommy bloggers caught it. And one of them was a victim of abuse. And so she caught this thing and it went viral. And so in some sense, it was a bit of a failed Trojan horse. But we're more concerned, especially as we go on in the show, is to point out the instances that aren't so obvious, those little worldview nudges that over time result in a radically altered trajectory.
So, Dave, what do you think we should do about this, or what do you think we should recommend parents do about this?
Well, honestly, Dan, having wrestled with this with having four kids, and when your children are young, when they're not old enough to have a discussion on these concepts, when you don't want to talk to them about touching genitals and pedophilia and something like Show Dogs, my advice is to simply avoid this stuff or severely limit this stuff from their life.
So I agree.
You know, fill their minds with good things. And I know a lot of people won't like this, but look, your kids are going to go over to some friend's house. They're going to figure out some way to watch this stuff, but at least it doesn't have to come with enthusiastic recommendations from you.
Dave, are you recommending complete abstinence?
Well, in some ways I am, especially when your kids are young. Look, St. Paul says, finally, brothers, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, whatever, if there's any excellence, if there's anything worthy of praise, think about these things. So when your kids are young, especially when they're young, fill their minds with the Bible story. Let that permeate and imprint and create a worldview that then they can use to cope with all this other stuff as they encounter it, right? And at best, these kind of movies are vacuous, they're inane. And at worst, they contain these Trojan horses, these ticking time bombs whose effects you won't see till years later when you try to have a conversation with your now tween or teen about gender or sexuality or even just about God. And you find out to your horror that they're espousing positions that are utterly incongruous with the worldview that you thought you were inculcating in them. That's when they're young. When they're old enough, though, that's when you need to help them develop a critical approach to everything that they consume. Essentially, teach them to not conform. Help them to develop an identity as those who do not conform. as St. Paul says, you know, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect.
And Dave, and to help them develop a critical approach, you should introduce your teens to the Not Conformed Show.
This is the Not Conformed Show. Make sure you tell everyone you know.
That's right, notconformed.show.
Now, the Trojan horse technique can take many forms, and one of these is what we can call the weak rebuttal. And it's time for everybody to wake up, because the next worldview change technique we're going to talk about is the weak rebuttal. Okay, now here's how this one works. A character makes a controversial claim, which is then refuted, but the refutation is feeble, it's inadequate, and somewhat unconvincing. And the implication that lingers in the minds of audiences is that there might indeed be some merit to the controversial claim that was made because it withstood the rebuttal. And one example of this weak rebuttal technique is in the movie Avengers Infinity War, in a scene that involves the villain whose name is Thanos. Just in the way of a quick background here, Thanos is concerned that there's much suffering in the worlds of the universe because of overpopulation. And his mission is to obtain a set of powerful stones that will give him unlimited power so that with the snap of his fingers, he can eliminate half of the human population and the similar dominant alien populations in other planets. Now, here's a clip of a conversation he has, this guy Thanos, with Gamora, an alien woman superhero whom Thanos raised sort of as his daughter after killing many of the people on her home planet.
I was a child when you took me.
I saved you.
No. No. We were happy on my home planet.
Going to bed hungry, scrounging for scraps. Your planet was on the brink of collapse. I'm the one who stopped that. Do you know what's happened since then? The children born have known nothing but full bellies and clear skies. It's a paradise.
Because you murdered half the planet.
A small price to pay for salvation.
You're insane.
All right, let's deconstruct this dialogue a little, Dave. So Thanos claims that he made Gamora's planet into a paradise, and Gamora notes that, yeah, he killed half the population, and she calls him insane. But, and here's the important part, she never challenges the premise that overpopulation was the problem and that reducing the population made the planet better.
Yeah.
So the Trojan horse idea here is a notion that reducing the population would make the world a better place and make the universe a better place. And the rebuttal of this idea is weak. The rebuttal is mainly focused on arguing against genocide as a tool of population reduction. But the rebuttal is not so much against the premise that reducing the population would make the world a better place. Does that make sense, Dave?
That makes sense, yep.
Okay. So then Thanos goes on to unpack his view of things, his worldview effectively, further. Listen to this.
Little one, it's a simple calculus. This universe is finite, its resources finite. If life is left unchecked, life will cease to exist. It needs correction.
You don't know that!
I'm the only one who knows that. At least I'm the only one with the will to act on it.
So Thanos believes that overpopulation will lead to the end of all life, and so there's this need for a population reduction. And obviously, this is a very strong claim. But notice that Gamora gives some pushback. She says, you don't know that, but it's really a weak refutation of Thanos' logic. She doesn't clearly say his premises are wrong or that the logic is flawed. She simply implies that he can't be certain of his claims. So again, a very weak refutation. And importantly, Thanos has the last unchallenged words. He says, at least I'm the only one with the will to act on it. And there is no rebuttal of this point.
Mm-hmm.
And as the viewers listen to all this, they might start to think to themselves, yeah, genocide is maybe not the best answer, but this Thanos guy might be onto something. After all, overpopulation is a problem, global warming and all that stuff. Someone should have the guts to do something. And they might think, Thanos is just doing what we all know must be done, but no one really has the guts to do. And so that's the kind of thought process that emerges when you have this weak rebuttal of this particular idea that the universe is overpopulated and that population reduction is important to make the universe and planets better places to be.
Yeah, and then notice how Thanos is portrayed also. He's got a great voice. He's very calm. And you know that this wasn't accidental because they carried the same idea into the next Avengers movie, the Avengers Endgame, where at one point, this is now several years after Thanos has succeeded and half the population of the universe has been snapped out of existence. We get the scene where Steve Rogers, that's Captain America, he walks in into an office and he comments enthusiastically to the Black Widow about how clean the water is and how there's fish now in the ocean and how well the environment is doing. And yeah, she kind of looks at him, and in the subsequent dialogue, they walk this back with the comments to the effect that it wasn't worth half the death of the population of the planet. But it leaves the viewer with the distinct impression that the planet is better off and that Thanos' theory has been empirically verified from the perspective of this virtuous Captain America. And remember what I said earlier about the consequences of accepting the assumptions of fictitious universes. See, once you grant the premises of this fictitious world, which naturally happens as part of your suspension of disbelief so you can enjoy the movie, the conclusions logically follow in that reality. And so you leave with the impression that this idea has somehow been empirically verified.
Yeah, Dave, you make some very important points here. I just want to reiterate two of your points. Mm-hmm. So the first is that Thanos, the bad guy, is very calm. He has a soothing, authoritative, almost paternal voice. And that's contrasted with the superheroes who are sometimes unhinged. They sometimes argue amongst each other. Their voices don't have the gravitas of Thanos' voice.
Mm-hmm.
So a big contrast there. And the second point you made is that the subversive theme of the need for depopulation is carried across several installments of the series, across several episodes, across several movies.
That's right. And so you get the principle of repetition, which we don't really have a right now. I don't have a concrete segment on, but it's used with all of these techniques.
I agree.
Dan, I really like this technique that you've identified, this half-hearted rebuttal. I think that's mm-hmm. a great one to keep an eye out for as we watch these things.
Well, let's move on to the next one. It's time to talk about the worldview change technique of inversion.
All right. So another technique used to nudge people's worldviews is what we're going to call inversion. Now, this involves taking what would be considered to be virtues, or they could be iniquities, based on the audience's pre-existing worldview, let's just say Christianity, and creating a worldview change by inverting these in the story. So, for example, inversion can take the form of associating pre-existing virtues with, let's say, a villain. So to create an inversion, the writer simply has to take the ideas that were previously seen as virtuous and put them in the mouth of the bad guy. And this way, you can simply smear by association any idea or thought or concept simply by putting it in the mouth of the villain.
Dave, do you have some examples of this, some concrete examples?
I do. And one is from another family blockbuster, the movie Incredibles 2. Now, before we roll this clip, I need to set it up because otherwise you'll be wondering what's going on. One of the themes that runs through both Incredibles movies is the debate about the role and value of those with superpowers in society. And at the beginning of the Incredibles, Incredibles 2, supers, as they call them, are banned and illegal. And part of the progression of this movie is to make the argument that these supers are actually good for society and perhaps even indispensable. And so the clip I want to play contains a monologue by a bad guy character going by the name Screenslaver. And the setting is you have Elastigirl, which is the mom in the super family. And she's on a mission to apprehend the villain, this Screenslaver, by luring him out by phoning in to a live news show to discuss footage of her last heroic escapade. And the Screenslaver's MO is to cut into these live broadcasts and to hypnotize people. And so the clip that you're going to hear is the monologue that he gives when he cuts into the live news feed.
Screenslaver interrupts this program for an important and now wants.
I'll be damned. She knew.
Let's see if your gadget works.
Don't bother watching the rest.
Gotcha.
Elastigirl doesn't save the day. She only postpones her defeat. And while she postpones her defeat, you eat chips and watch her confront problems that you are too lazy to deal with. Superheroes are part of your brainless desire to replace true experience with simulation. You don't talk, you watch talk shows. You don't play games, you watch game shows. Travel, relationships, risk. Every meaningful experience must be packaged and delivered to you to watch at a distance so that you can remain ever sheltered, ever passive, ever ravenous consumers who can't bring themselves to rise from their couches, break a sweat, and participate in life. You want superheroes to protect you and make yourselves ever more powerless in the process, while you tell yourself you're being looked after, that your interests are being served, that your rights are being upheld, so that the system can keep stealing from you, smiling at you all the while. Go ahead, send your supers to stop me. Grab your snacks, watch your screens, and see what happens. You are no longer in control. I am.
So hopefully you caught that monologue. I know his voice is a little bit, it's modified to obfuscate it so that you don't really find out what the identity of this bad guy is until much later. But there are many great points that he makes in this monologue. Even the name Screenslaver, right? It highlights people's passivity and enslavement to screens, or the living vicariously through the characters on the show, or the criticism of this passive handing over of our liberties while being placated by entertainment, or the problem with the whole idea of superheroes. And this is a major theme in the entire movie, as I said, which is essentially an emotional debate about whether supers should be legal and accepted by society, and on it goes. And all of these good points are simply dismissed, not with reasoned arguments, but by being put in the mouth of the despicable or at least wrong-headed bad guy. And so if anyone tries to make these points in the real world, they're already tarnished by association and dismissed through this tactic. It's kind of a weird ad hominem attack.
Dave, could it be that the writer is simply using the villain's monologue to alert the audience and explain the technique that is being used against them in superhero films? In other words, is it possible that the writer is actually trying to communicate a positive message to the audience?
Well, in this case, I would say no, although you could take it that way if you don't know the background. But I would say no, because the story arc of the show is all about promoting superheroes. And so the point of the villain's monologue is to simply proactively dismiss this criticism against the promotion of superheroes by associating the criticism with the villain. And they never really get back to this. They just simply put it on the bad guy, and they don't actually address these points.
Yeah, I have a quote here from the actual monologue. Superheroes are part of your brainless desire to replace true experience with simulation. And they put that into the mouth of this villain. And of course, the story arc is all about, of the actual show, is all about promoting superheroes. So I think you're absolutely right. This is a case where a very valid criticism of this whole superhero genre is put in the mouth of the villain, and then in that sense, vilified. And that's the inversion you're talking about.
Yeah, let's not ask any questions or talk about why we maybe shouldn't be, you know, getting so enthusiastic about these movies and why they shouldn't be earning $2.79 billion.
Dan, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, Dan, I was listening to a podcast, the IEW podcast, which is Institute for Excellence in Writing. And the founder of IEW, Andrew Poudois, makes some really good points criticizing this superhero movie craze. And I've got a clip from the podcast. It's a minute 52. And the best one is at the very end, but the whole thing is worth listening to. So if you can roll that for me, and let's have a listen.
It's interesting. I've thought a lot about the superhero craze. You know how we've, in the last couple decades, had this boom of big screen, high budget movies,
Marvel, DC,
superheroes.
Yes.
Why? what is it that we crave mm-hmm. that's being fulfilled by superheroes? Mm. And I think it's because we've actually become disconnected mm. with our own heroes. Mm. I think comic books had to be born in America because Europe still had more of a tradition, even a Christian tradition.
Just pause like, for a second.
Like,
yeah, just I know, listening to it now, you just ignore the his co-host, his female co-host on this one, and just listen to what he's got.
Now everybody's going to be listening to it. Okay, let me play it. Okay, I just rewound it a little bit.
What is it that we crave mm-hmm. that's being fulfilled by superheroes? Mm. And I think it's because we've actually become disconnected mm. with our own heroes. Mm. I think comic books had to be born in America because Europe still had more of a tradition, even a Christian tradition of saints and great people. Mm-hmm. And we lost that. Mm-hmm. We have our own kind of great people. But then recently, what's happened? They've even kind of been slammed,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
If
yeah,
you pick up the newest history book that is to prepare AP students for mm-hmm. U.S. history, it's got just a few paragraphs about George Washington and the fact that he owned slaves.
Yeah, Dave, it's just pause it there for a second because mm-hmm. this relates to our previous point about rewriting history or recasting history in a different light. So
yeah, absolutely.
What the host there or the person who's being interviewed is saying is that our previous heroes are being recast in a negative light.
Yeah, which requires a substitution. And then at the end of this clip, he'll talk about the effect that this has. And I've got some comments myself. So go ahead and finish rolling the clip.
Mm. Right. It was dominant. You get just a few paragraphs about Thomas Jefferson, and he owned slaves. Mm-hmm. You get a few paragraphs about Ronald Reagan, and he had the most expensive inaugural celebration of any president to date.
So all of our heroes are being tarnished.
Our heroes are being tarnished. Mm-hmm. Exactly. A very good way to phrase that. So then, you know, who do children look up to?
Since Iron Man.
We don't have any real ones. We need to now enthrone mm-hmm. the fictitious ones. Mm-hmm. But I'm not even sure this is good. Mm. Because you could aspire to be like a great person who actually lived. Mm-hmm. But you cannot aspire to have superpowers. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there's a disconnect there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that point about the disconnect and the that disconnect being the effect of rewriting history is a great point. And I would actually add this, is that not only can you not aspire to have superpowers, I would say that many people in our society, and that's the problem, do aspire to have superpowers. And mm-hmm. what happens is they either waste their young adulthood, and nowadays actually their adulthood, daydreaming about having these superpowers, thereby making them completely unproductive, and their vital youthful energies are being sapped away into these virtual worlds that they constantly seek to escape to from real life whenever it is offered.
Yeah, Dave, I actually had a student who was a big gamer, and he would spend hours and hours just gaming. And at one point he said, you know, I don't really care about living in the real world because I could have a much more interesting experience in these virtual worlds. So for some people, this is acknowledged and it's very explicit that they're actually making this decision to engage in these other worlds because the games give them all these capacities, all these superpower-like capacities. And I just add one more thing, and that is that people are also, I think, trying to augment themselves, and particularly with various kinds of drugs. And we know people are, you know, trying to take stimulants, for instance, to perform better. And I suspect that as soon as a technology comes on the market that's going to be able to augment people's abilities, we're going to see people rushing to use those technologies, even if they're implanted, to be able to have greater capacities, greater abilities, and to be more superhero-like, because they're being brainwashed, essentially, at this point in time, that that's the ultimate goal, is to just achieve more, to be better, to be stronger, to have superpower abilities.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, you've seen the articles this past week about Elon Musk talking about
the Neuralink,
you know, be ready, exactly ready in the next year or so, right?
Yeah, exactly. He's all about enhancing the human cognitive ability. And the argument they put forward there, right, is we have to do it in order to keep up with AI and the machines. We can get into this in another episode when we talk about transhumanism, but that's a very important worldview that we have to deconstruct. Absolutely.
Yeah, and so let me just finish with one more other aspect that I've seen happen. Either you waste your your life aspiring to have these superpowers, or people actually go through in a deluded way, simply arrogantly imagining themselves to be this entitled Superman or Superwoman that lives outside and above the boundaries of human morality and human law. And you get a lot of this kind of antisocial type behavior happening. And I remember sitting there in Cineplex before one of these movies and this Lexus car commercial basically catering precisely to this mentality. just starkly, you know, you're above the law, you're outside convention. I wish I could have clipped it. I've never been able to find it, but it would be the perfect clip for this episode and as an illustration.
Yeah, working outside the law is definitely a common theme in these vigilante-style superhero films. Dave, another example of this technique of inversion can be found in Jessica Jones, the Marvel show that we mentioned earlier. And in season 3 of the show, she's trying to track down the bad guy whose name is Salinger, and Salinger murders people who he sees as advancing in life by cheating. And he sees powered people, people like Jessica Jones, those with these augmented abilities, as being cheaters. Now listen to this dialogue as Salinger explains his view to a powered person that he captures. So, and in fact, this powered person is that guy, Eric, who can, just by being around people, get headaches if they've done something evil. So he's around this Salinger bad guy, and so he has a massive headache every time Salinger approaches him.
You say it's because I lack empathy, because I'm evil.
Basically.
Evil's the wrong word. I am asserting fairness in an unfair world. I'm vengeful, without pity, appropriately cruel. Those are the things you're sensing, not evil. You cheaters, you all think you're so superior, but it's just an unfair advantage, like lifts in your shoes. All I am is a man with my feet on the ground and a brain in my head. And yet I can bring pain to power just by getting close. I have the only superpower that is not a fraud, because it was evolved through sheer human pain. And that is extraordinary, because it's real.
So here we have Salinger, the bad guy, and he's essentially against human augmentation and against the powered people, as they are called. And so what the writers are doing here is taking the view that human augmentation or transhumanism is problematic, a view that from some worldviews, like maybe from the Christian worldview, might have merit, and associating that view with the villain, who then commits murder based on that view. So the message is that if you criticize human augmentation and transhumanism and this whole superhero creation by you know, various means, genetic mutation or medical intervention or whatever, then you're evil, like this villain Salinger.
Yeah, that's a great point, Dan. We're going to have to get into this this transhumanism business. We'll make an episode out of it. And I think it's a fantastic point. So, Dan, so I have one more example of inversion from the TV show Supergirl, which is now on Netflix. And this is from a showdown between Supergirl and her nemesis, the villain Rain.
So you're supposed to be the devil?
The devil isn't real.
And who are you?
I'm from the time before fathoming. Born to cleanse the scourge and deliver the awakening. I am Rain.
How did you get here?
I survived Krypton's death, sent here upon its destruction.
If that's true, then where have you been?
Dispensing justice.
By terrorizing people? Killing people?
This world has sunken into chaos and sin. Too many have eluded judgment. I'm not gonna let you hurt anyone else.
Surrender now before I make you surrender.
So full of hubris, just like the righteous Kryptonians who feared my makers, worshiping false gods as they watched our planet suffocate by shame and burn from memory. Stand down, or I will make you join them in their purgatory.
I'm not going anywhere.
And I will dispense my justice on you.
So note the Christian language or the Christian type language about sin and justice and judgment in these clips.
Yes, indeed.
There's another one. Yeah, maybe just roll the next one and we can talk about it.
You are no God, just as I'm no devil. All I am is truth and judgment. Death, and I will reign.
Yeah, and afterward, you find out that this Rain character is part of a trinity. In fact, that's an episode title that follows a few episodes down from this one. And the other two in her cohort are Purity and Pestilence.
And so this character, so, Rain, that's the evil character in the show. And
that's right.
And it's interesting that she says, I'm no devil.
Yeah, that's right. And you're no God. There's a lot of loaded language here. And just like above with Thanos, when he talks about this is the price of salvation, right? They're putting these basically this is an example of what happens with inversion when the authors try to vilify God. They vilify God by putting the words or the works of God into the mouth of these and into the actions of the villains. So a favorite of to attack is, of course, God's motives in the work of the flood, right? There's just this righteousness that's required and the cleansing of the completely corrupt world, or the book of Revelation and the coming judgment are often vilified by inversion, or even simply, as we saw, God's demands for purity and righteousness. Right, all these things are vilified by putting it in the mouth of the bad guy by being this. It's inverted. Basically, just make God look like the bad guy. And if you're not paying attention, sometimes this can vary in its subtlety how they drop these little lines into these characters.
I think the general principle here is that the good characters and the evil characters typically have different vocabularies. And similarly, Christians have a different vocabulary and different concepts than do non-Christians. And the inversion here is to put the Christian conceptual vocabulary in the mouth of the villain in order to vilify it.
Yeah, that's right. And this is just one example. They actually, in the superhero genre, they do this quite often. And there's always one of these characters that is this kind of seemingly righteous but evil character. And there's a design behind that.
Yeah. Now, of course, inversion can take other forms. So far, we've discussed the vilification of what would be considered virtues based on a pre-existing worldview, let's say a pre-existing Christian worldview. But inversion can also occur when characteristics that are seen as negative or even evil from a Christian worldview, let's say, are associated with a hero. And we could call this type of inversion lionization. So previously, we gave examples of vilification. Now, let's consider lionization. And some great examples of inversion that takes the form of lionization can be found in the Avengers Infinity War. And you'll recall that the movie is essentially a story of this group of superheroes that overcome their differences and join forces to battle an evil character. We've met him already. That's Thanos. And Thanos' goal is to eliminate half the population of not only the Earth, but also the entire universe. And so the superheroes are willing to risk everything, their own safety, to save the people of the universe, right? So that's the enticing Trojan horse, the outer skin of that horse, right? But the film is replete with examples of inversion taking the form of lionization. And simply consider the nature of the superheroes who are the good guys in this Marvel universe, the Avengers, as they are called. What characteristics do they promote? Well, let's consider a few. We have the Black Panther, who you might recall from an earlier episode of the show, is a guy who is possessed by an entity through a shamanic ritual that involved the use of psychedelic drugs. And then there's Thor, the god of thunder, who is from an alien planet but has godlike powers. Another character is the Star-Lord, who in the Marvel Cinematic Universe is a human-alien hybrid that looks human. And what other guys are there, Dave?
Well, you've got Captain America, who's, made nearly indestructible and given superpowers in a military laboratory, being injected with a drug. So he's scientifically, chemically augmented. And then you've got Tony Stark, the narcissistic, super rich guy who's Iron Man, who augments his abilities by a technological suit and is powered by a power sword that's implanted in his chest, right? So you've got, again, these transhumanistic themes.
Yes. And I'm remembering another character is Doctor Strange, who uses mystical powers he learned from Eastern mysticism and if I remember correctly, honed at a monastery. And he can cast spells and travel through portals to different places and even to point different points in time. Because I think in the movie, he travels into the future and actually not just one future, but many possible futures. And that's exactly what a shaman does, right? So he has shamanic characteristics. And then there is a character called Vision, who is an artificial intelligence, and he has a synthetic body. And in the show, he's in an intimate relationship with another Avenger named the Scarlet Witch, who is literally a witch.
Yeah. Yeah. She actually hexes people.
Right? Yeah, I know. This is crazy. And we could go on and on here, but the point is that the heroes are made to reflect the pagan worldview and to extol the virtues of transhumanism, which broadly defined is the chemical and mechanical augmentation of humans. The subtle yet extremely effective technique here is to imbue the heroes with characteristics that one wishes to subversively introduce into the audience's worldview. And viewers come to lionize these heroic characteristics, and in so doing, they accept the character's traits as being good and virtuous. In the context of the Avengers, the viewers are essentially being told that they should admire and revere this ragtag band that includes chemically and mechanically augmented humans and humanoid artificial intelligences and human-alien hybrids and shamans and witches and warlocks. I mean, listen, how could witchcraft and wizardry be wrong when you have the Scarlet Witch and Doctor Strange fighting to save humanity and the entire universe? How could intimacy between, let's say, humans and machines be so bad when you see Vision, the AI, and the Scarlet Witch have such a wonderful relationship on screen? What we're seeing here is that the characteristics that are considered to be evil and bad from a Christian worldview are exalted, they're magnified and lauded in this cinematic Marvel pantheon of heroes. So I think this is an excellent example of this technique we called inversion through the process of lionization.
Yeah, Dan, as you're talking, I'm thinking of a Bible verse from Isaiah 52, and listen how nicely it applies to this technique and inversion that we've been talking about. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter.
That's a perfect verse that reveals the diabolical nature of what we're calling inversion.
Yeah, woe to those.
So Dave, looking at our list here, and I noticed that we have some more worldview change techniques to cover. But since we've already been going for over an hour, how about we leave some of these for the next episode, and maybe we can summarize things and then end with one more key point.
Yeah, let's do that. I have a whole pile of excellent clips with a technique we're going to call commingling, but that's just the tease for the next episode now.
All right. So overall, I guess the point here is that fiction, and especially these popular superhero films and TV shows, are effective vehicles for subversive content that can create substantial worldview change. And there are many techniques that can be implemented in the context of fictional stories that can occasion this worldview change. We discuss how writers have control over the constraints of their fictional reality so that they can make your worldview incoherent in their reality.
We also mentioned the Trojan horse technique, whereby worldview change is created by cunningly placed subversive elements among the dominant story elements that are consistent with the audience's pre-existing worldview. We also mentioned the weak rebuttal, that is the weak rebuttal of controversial assertions that leave the audience thinking that there may be merit to those assertions. And then we talked about the technique of inversion that involves both vilifying and lionizing to create worldview change.
Yeah, Dave, I don't think we can overstate the effectiveness of these techniques. And I think a lot of Christians might be unaware of just how pervasively these techniques are used in the film industry. I have here a Christian magazine from a very conservative denomination. And in this particular issue, there is a movie review of the Marvel movie Ant-Man and the Wasp. And it's a glowing review. The title says, Family Positive Film. And in it we read, if marriage in North American culture is a car in the ditch, Ant-Man and the Wasp is doing its part to help push it out of the ditch and back onto the road. And then later on we read, both Casey and Hope are excellent examples of characters working to keep the fourth commandment. Honor your father and your mother. Just as Hank Pym and Janet Van Dyne are excellent film examples of characters who work to keep the sixth commandment, in which husband and wife love and honor each other. Now, yes, Ant-Man might give you some light rinse, feel-good family morals, but that's just the outer skin covering the subversive ideas in the film. That's just the outer skin of the Trojan horse. The author of this review piece is asking us to take the Trojan horse into our city. Remember, this is a Christian magazine.
Yeah, I found a clip of a movie review from, this is from Focus on the Family, that does precisely this kind of thing, just makes Ant-Man sound like a great family movie. Why don't you roll that one and we can talk about it.
I can fight bad guys like you.
The movie Ant-Man and the Wasp scurries back into the life of Scott Lang, also known as the Ant-Man. Thanks to a special suit, he has the incredible ability to shrink to the size of a microbe or swell to the height of a mountain. When in that super garb, he can beat back any baddie and grapple with any wrongdoing. The problem is, he's currently under house arrest and grappling with the consequences of his past actions. If he wants to stay out of jail and stay with his beloved daughter, he better stay in line.
Maybe you just need someone watching your back. Like a partner.
Of course, the super suit's creator, Dr. Hank Pym, and his daughter Hope, also known as the Wasp, may have something to say about that. They have an urgent Ant-Man-worthy mission that requires Scott's immediate attention.
You gave her wings and blasters.
But for a few small mandible nips, this superhero sequel is almost perfect. It has a real nice balance of action, fun and sweet messages about the loving joys of family, and the need for self-sacrificial choices. The one little wasp in the ointment is the movie's rough language. It's nothing out of the ordinary for your typical superhero pick, but it's a ants at the picnic annoyance. I'll give Ant-Man and the Wasp 3.5 quantum tunnel leaps out of 5 for family friendliness. Now, for an in-depth review of the film, or really anything else at your local box office, be sure to visit us at PluggedIn.com. Plugging you into the movies, I'm Bob Olszewski for Focus on the Family's Plugged In Movie Review.
Yeah, it blows my mind to listen to this, Dave.
It's Focus on the Family. These guys are supposed to be some kind of Christian conservative outfit. And the one little wasp, the one little ants at the picnic annoyance is just simply a little bit of language. I mean, if that's all this guy sees, he must have gone into the movie with a blindfold on or something like that. You know, I haven't seen the movie recently, so I can't give you a full deconstruction, but I can guarantee you that if we sat there, we could pick out a whole bunch of Trojan horses that are in this movie, or at the very least, because this movie plugs you into the 22-plus movie universe and space opera, all that other stuff is coming in, because you're not just going to see this thing. You're going to go and see the other ones as well, right?
Well, yeah. And I mean, minimally, you've got these notions of transhumanism, right? That because these are these superheroes, yep, that have special powers. So even if everything else is fine, you're still being sold the idea that it's very positive to have this augmented abilities, these non-human abilities. And of course, it's wrapped in things like self-sacrificial choices. That's one of the things that he points out in that review. It's really good because it demonstrates people making self-sacrificial choices. Well, again, that's what I would call the outer skin of this Trojan horse. That's what draws you in. And then out come the enemy, which in this case, at minimum, is transhumanism.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing is this family values. There's a couple of reviews, actually, Google it, and there's a couple of reviews that pop up when you Ant-Man family values. This is from Slate.com, and here's how they open this review. The Marvel Universe is so filled with absent, inadequate, withholding, and sometimes outright crappy fathers that it sometimes seems as if daddy issues are what keep it spinning. Tony Stark is still haunted by tensions left unresolved at the time of his father's death. T'Challa struggles to live up to his father's legacy. Thor's been through all sorts of nonsense with Odin. Peter Parker grew up without his father, and so did Peter Quill, which, considering that he was eventually revealed to be a murderous jerk as well as a near omnipotent cosmic being, might have been for the best. Part of what sets Marvel's Ant-Man and its new sequel, Ant-Man and the Wasp, apart from the rest of the Marvel movies, aside from their literally small scale and relatively low stakes, is a hero whose primary motivation is to reverse this trend and an interest in the ways a broken family can be pieced back together. So I think there's a new technique here, the low bar technique.
Yeah.
they start with such a low bar that, oh, this is a family movie compared to the other 222 movies.
We need to look, Dave, I got to give you one of these for that.
Awesome, Uncle Dave.
The low bar technique right at the end of our show here. But Dave, listen to what's happening here, man. I think this is a perfect example of how they're replacing the perfect Christ of Christianity with these flawed pagan engineered superheroes. And even the Christians are welcoming them in.
Yeah, yeah. Basically, the pagan gods of antiquity, right? And in some of it, it's very blatant, like Thor.
Yeah.
Dan, I'm reminded about the comments you made about dissonance, and I wonder if these positive movie reviews aren't simply the dissonance of the reviewers, especially these Christian reviewers, somehow trying to justify their watching of these movies.
Yeah, I think that might very well be the case. They watch the movies, and in order to eliminate dissonance or this internal conflict between their worldview and the worldview that's being communicated in the movies, what they're doing is only focusing on the positive aspect of the movies. And then, in fact, they turn almost into evangelists for the movies. Yeah, very deep, very deep psychological dynamic that's unfolding with this. And we maybe spend some time later on deconstructing it further.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a lot more we could say on this topic, and we certainly have more worldview change techniques to discuss, which means that our listeners should tune in to future episodes of the Not Conformed podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got this clip list that I've been dragging from episode to episode because we never seem to get to it. But next episode, we're going to get to it. And that's the commingling. And I got this other great segment that I'm not going to reveal until we actually show it. So,
yeah. Well, Dave, why don't you take us out then with a closing?
All right. So where to find us? On the web, you can find us at notconform.show. And there you'll find individual episode pages, show notes, subscribe links, and embedded players to listen online and all that kind of stuff. And really, the website is the best way to spread the word about the show. Just point them to notconformed.show. And we really need your help in getting the word out there. Also, we'd like to thank all of those who have sent us feedback and links to articles. We greatly appreciate that, and we want to encourage you to keep it coming. Just email us at info@notconform.show. And especially if you're watching movies and you catch some of these things that we're talking about, some of these techniques, and you got good illustrations, just send us a quick note, and ideally a time code would be great so we can just zoom in right to that thing, and perhaps we'll feature them in a clip in an upcoming episode. So Dan, that's basically it in a nutshell. Notconform.show and info@notconform.show.
Okay, Dave, I'll talk to you later.
Looking forward to it.